From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made a few years ago at Tufts University, where a professor of urban and environmental planning noticed something. In working with his students and with urban designers, he noticed the environmental part of the planning was often being dropped. Why? Well, he was told, time and time again, that environmental planning is for activists. Urban planning is about building the economy, creating jobs, creating spaces where people want to go. This professor thought we needed a bit more of an egalitarian approach. He thought that design should be responsible, with an eye toward justice and opportunity, both for people who wanted to come to those areas, but also for people already living there. He thought consumption should be responsible. And that raises an interesting question. When we talk about design, about community planning, should we be thinking about equity, about justice, environmental justice too? Often we talk about what kind of businesses will thrive, what kind of developments make sense, where to move the traffic, how to accommodate commuters. Well, the Community Design Center of Rochester is hosting a discussion next week to answer the question, what is equity by design? There will be a focus on how to design a more equitable Rochester region with a look at both sustainability and social justice to improve quality of life. For this event, the Design Center is bringing in two speakers, Dr. Julian Ajeman, a professor of urban and environmental policy at Tufts University, the man I was just talking about. He's the creator of the concept of just sustainabilities, which is the full integration of social justice and sustainability, and he'll explain more next week. They're also going to have Anne-Marie Lubinow, who's an architect and the director of the Rudy Bruner Award, which focuses on urban projects that create both economic and social vitality. This hour, we have Anne-Marie on the line with us to talk about these issues. She's coming next week. Anne-Marie, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. Also here is Mo Duggan, the Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Mo, nice to have you back.
Thank you, Evan.
And also here is Howard Decker, a board member of the Community Design Center and architect. Nice to see you back here as well, Howard.
Evan, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Mo, I want to start with you because this question of equity of design is probably more timely than ever in our community because there's a lot happening downtown.
Yes.
There's a lot of new spaces being created. There's a lot of redevelopment of spaces. And we are in the midst of an anti-poverty initiative that is ambitious, that is really, really aiming to change the shape of poverty and reduce poverty in Rochester. We don't always think about these things working together. Is this why this time makes sense to you?
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the things that what we're seeing, too, is that there's a lot of fantastic efforts to help alleviate poverty, to help address some of these issues. But we're also saying, look, the design of the neighborhood in which people live can play a real role. And it's about equity. It's also about access. It's about access to good home housing, to good transportation network, to goods and services in your community and healthcare. So we want to really shine a light on that because this is another part of the prism, and this is an area that we can really be impactful in.
And I'm going to ask Anne-Marie about the Rudy Bruner Awards that I think are so tied up in these values. And if you look at specific examples around the country, which we're about to do, it's fascinating to see what's going on. But Howard Decker, in the light of equity by design in Rochester, you know, we were just talking about what to do with the new space created by filling part of the inner loop. We've been talking about new developments downtown. We've been talking about multimodal futures, et cetera. But as we talk about that, how to you does equity by design fit in?
Well, I think whether we're talking about a city neighborhood or a suburban neighborhood, we're talking about wanting to make sure that the neighbors have, as Mo said, access to opportunity, to the goods and services that we all need to lead a decent life, and also choice. I think one of the things that's so often missing in neighborhoods, especially poorer neighborhoods or neighborhoods that have been ignored, is a lack of choice. I don't have the right to choose or the ability to choose where I buy my food, how I wash my clothes, how I get to work. And so I think one of the things that we're thinking about in terms of the urban environment as designers is how to create the greatest sense of access and the greatest number of choices consistently for the greatest number of people at all times.
And, you know, I think one of the faults I have in hosting these discussions is I don't think I fully realized when we talked multimodal transportation just how much justice gets tied up there, Howard, mm-hmm. because we talked about that, and that is a big issue, and a lot of our listeners want to talk about it. They want to think about, you know, a future where we're a little less tied up in the automobile. Nobody likes the automobile less than Howard Decker, in my experience. But, you know, I haven't always tied that to justice and opportunity.
Right.
And that's probably a fault of my own privilege, right?
I actually think that transportation is probably the easiest subject to focus on when one is talking about equity in urban design, because I think it's one that people can understand the easiest and can imagine in the clearest possible way. But if you live in the El Camino neighborhood, for example, where we are doing our work now, can you get to work? Do you have access to transportation? Does it take you 2 hours to get to work? If the bus doesn't come, will you get fired? And so it's easy to talk about transportation and access to the greatest number of transportation choices in a place like that. But in fact, we have extraordinary transportation challenges throughout the region that affect suburbanites, city dwellers, everybody.
Yeah, if we live in a world where you must have a car and you must be able to drive that car often and long distances, that may not be very difficult for some people. Anne-Marie Lubinow, let me turn the question to you then. Equity of design, equity by design, what does that mean to you? And then I want to talk specifically about where you've looked around the country and offered these Rudy Bruner Awards. What does that term mean to you?
Sure. Well, I think it's already been touched upon that certainly equity has a strong association with access. And I think the design of the built environment really affects all aspects of our lives. It affects where we live, how we get to work, where we work, our access to parks and open space. So these threads of transit, you know, how do we have access to transit, how do we have access to jobs, form a strong connection through the conversation of equity and design.
And so as we look at the Rudy Bruner Awards, tell us how the mission for this formed here. What is the mission of these awards?
Sure. Well, the premise of the Rudy Bruner Award is that good design has a social, economic, and environmental impact. So often in the field of design, we focus on the physical object, you know, the building as an object. And it's easy to forget sometimes that when we design buildings, when we design places, we're designing places for people. So our goal with the Rudy Bruner Award is to really help people understand the transformative power of design, the impact it has on people's lives, and also the impact it has in shaping America's cities. It was founded at a time when American cities were in crisis in the 1980s as a way of fostering conversation about how we can make cities better through design.
And looking at the 2015 awards, the gold medal goes to Miller's Court in Baltimore, Maryland. And for listeners, if you're listening online or you could do this now, it's interesting to kind of Google some of these places and check out just the aesthetic for the first of all. It's fun to see what people are doing and how creative the minds across our country are, but just how functional as well. So this is something that we can relate to in Rochester. I think probably most communities can relate to. You've got an old, in this case, a tin can manufacturing company, but, you know, I mean, right next door, there's an old button factory. They're using it in interesting ways. There's all kinds of buildings in communities where you're looking at imagining use here. So this is a new use for an old industrial building, and Miller's Court in Baltimore is described as an urban oasis for teachers and nonprofits. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. As you mentioned, it's a renovation of a historic manufacturing building that's on a major artery that connects downtown Baltimore with the neighborhoods in the city. It includes 40 apartments that are affordably priced for teachers, and it also includes office space for educational nonprofits. So it was created by a local mission-oriented development team that wanted to help attract people to the city of Baltimore, which they love, and also recognizing that in order for us to really address the issue of the quality of education, which is such an important issue in all of our communities across the United States, that one of the reasons we can do this is by providing, as they put it, a safe landing place for teachers that are coming to teach in an urban school district.
Yeah, I saw this, and the first question I had was, is it because we want more teachers who teach in urban settings to live in urban settings, or is this you wanted to use design to give teachers kind of a creative space where they could maybe be outdoors in an urban setting, which is but also sort of relaxed and take a little stress off? Is it a combination of those things?
Absolutely. It is a combination of the two, that when the project was initiated, the goal was to create a place, provide affordable, high-quality housing for teachers, so that they could encourage them to come live in Baltimore. Not only come live in Baltimore and work there for a while, but ideally to fall in love with the city and to make a decision to stay. So that was the first goal. And then part of the idea behind the project is not only to just provide apartments, but to create a sense of community, to provide a way for teachers, that many of whom this is their first job coming out of school, have the ability to connect with peers that are working in similar situations. Teach for America is actually one of the nonprofit organizations that's inside the building. So a number of the residents are Teach for America participants, so they have the benefit of close proximity to that support network. And then additionally, the goal of the developer, Seawall Development Company, was also to help connect the teachers and nonprofits with the neighborhood and the city of Baltimore at large. So again, creating this sense of community, because we all know that when we've got strong social networks, it's easier for us to thrive in the work that we do, and in turn for our communities to do well.
The silver medalists, and there are a number of them. I'm looking at Falls Park on the Reedy River in Greenville, South Carolina, previously an industrial site with mills. And about 25 years ago, some of the acres were reclaimed by a garden club, and a landscape architect developed a master plan for a park there. 10th anniversary was in 2014. Our intern, Kate, tells us TripAdvisor gives us great ratings there, all kinds of good reviews on what's going on there. Why was it on your list, Falls Park on the Reedy River in Greenville, South Carolina?
Sure. It was one of the submissions for 2015, and it's a very exciting project. I think Falls Park shares a narrative with many of our American cities that over time the city was first founded along the banks of the Reedy River because it was a source of water and also a source of power for early mills. But over time, as industry thrived, it became really it served industry rather than the public good. Over time, the city itself turned its back on the river. And really through the vision and leadership of multiple city leaders over 100 years, the story of Falls Park on the Reedy is actually fascinating because it dates back to a early 1900s study that was commissioned by city leadership at the time by a firm based in Baltimore to look at what could be done to help help create a framework for the city for the future. And that first study identified the river and the falls as being a point of potential for the city. And over the succeeding decades, through various leadership among the community, including the Garden Club, there were efforts to first begin to clean up the river valley. And then more recently, some planning that developed a strategy for redeveloping the river valley as a park, creating pathways to lead people into the park. And then actually one of the boldest moves in that project was to replace a vehicular bridge that was constructed, if you could imagine this, directly over the falls themselves. The river valley had become so forgotten that a roadway bridge was built over the falls. And as part of the planning initiatives that were underway, the idea emerged to remove that bridge and instead create a new pedestrian bridge that crossed the river just below the falls, providing a spectacular viewpoint of the falls, and then a beautiful suspension cable bridge that has become a focus and part of the city's identity.
So that's Falls Park on the Reedy River. And by the way, we're talking to Anne-Marie Lubenow, the director of the Rudy Brunner Award for Urban Excellence, and she's going to be here a week from today for the Reshaping Rochester series at Gleason Works Auditorium, 7 to 9, next Tuesday night. Tickets still available, and it's easy to find. cdcrochester.org if you want to get tickets and come out for that discussion for a number of reasons, because Anne-Marie is going to be there. But you also have a second speaker, Mo, who is really sort of remarkable.
Julian Ajaman is, as you said earlier in the conversation, somebody that has broken down a couple of really interesting silos. And I think when people come there, people that care about the environment, people that care about social justice, and realize that they're not two separate conversations, they're one and the same. And Julian's going to talk to us about why they are and why when you advance one, you can advance the other. I think between Anne-Marie and Julian, we are really lucky because you've got the full gamut of And truly, I can't think of two better people to kick off the series and really set the stage for what we're going to talk about for the entire theme for the next four speakers. So we're delighted.
And on this list here, Howard and Moe,
right.
You're going to be talking about what's going on in Greenville as well? Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
We're going to have Mayor White, the mayor of Greenville, come and tell us about the project that Anne-Marie has just described and to tell us what lessons they've learned in Greenville about living in a city that has a river running through it and a waterfall in the middle.
If only we could relate.
Yeah, if we just could think of a place that might be similar somehow.
Well, but we've got it all figured out with the river and the falls. You know, I mean, like, it is fascinating to see some of the parallels, and not perfect parallels, but there's always a lot to learn. That's what the series is about. It's about hearing perspectives from around the country, learning from them. And so Anne-Marie is going to be here next week. Again, tickets available. And before we continue the discussion with Anne-Marie Lubinow and Howard Decker and Moe Duggan from the Community Design Center of Rochester, my colleague Scott Feibusch is stopping in because we still have a way to go to try to get to our goal. If we reach enough funding from our community today, the moment we reach it, we're done with the drive. But we're not there yet.
That is correct, and it is also correct we're not there. But there is good news. We're up to the $83,000 mark. So progress is being made. That's
okay.
The first piece of good news. Second piece of good news is we have a challenge that is underway for the next 38 minutes or so of the show. Thanks to a longtime 25-year member of WXXI, she is in Canandaigua, and she is matching your dollars, dollar for dollar, when you call 454-6300 in Rochester, 800-295-9994, from anywhere, WXXI.org, WEOS.org, or the mobile app, however you pledge, those dollars get matched, and they go to support conversations like what you are hearing right now. I can safely assure you that nowhere on commercial media, anywhere in Greater Rochester or the Finger Lakes, are you hearing discussion of urban planning. Never mind at this depth that you're hearing it.
And every time we talk about this, our community responds, Scott. They want to talk about this. They care very deeply. There, I think for a number of years, there was this misconception that if you don't live in the city, you're not really interested. And that is absolutely not true. Witness the discussion we recently had about what to do with the filled interloop space, et cetera. There's also this idea that design is only the city. It's not. It's a region-wide thing. It's a community thing. We're talking about things that can stitch communities together beyond just a street or a section of downtown. And these issues are continuing discussions on this program. Joe writes to us and says, I'm a sustaining member, and this show is a huge reason why. Joe, thank you very much. It's great to hear that. We have some new members just from the last hour as well, and you can either become a member or renew your membership or add to that by calling right now, 454-6300, 454-6300, and your dollars are doubled right now until about 2 o'clock.
Yes, indeed. We want to thank Christine in Fairport, Carrie Andrews in Rochester, who I suspect related to our conversation about being
Carrie
able
called.
To talk politics on the radio at length, in depth, without commercial interference. Be like them. Make that call right now. And the sooner you do, you are, A, showing your support for what Evan does here every day on Connections, and you're helping us to get that drive done faster. 454-6300, 800-295-9994, WXXI.org, WEOS.org, the mobile app. There are lots of ways to do it. We give you all those ways. The one thing we can't do is drag your finger to those buttons. You got to do that yourself.
All right, and one more point before we end this little pitch here, which is this. Last hour, Scott and I talked about the fact that around the country, NPR member stations, generally, most of them don't have local talk shows anymore, and certainly fewer now than there used to be. Is that right, Scott?
That is definitely true. It's an expensive thing to sustain. You have to support a host. You have to support a production staff. You have to keep the studio space maintained. There's a lot of wear and tear just from people coming in and out every day. Make sure all the mics and the headphones keep working. That all takes money. All those little bits add up. Just like maintaining an urban environment adds up. Same kind of thing.
Absolutely.
There are ongoing costs, and that's what we depend on you to do. It's why we come to you with this one-day drive, and it's why we give you that opportunity to end it quickly with that call.
And in this case, we mentioned Kate Cowie Haskell is doing great work for us. Every week now is our intern, Megan Mack, producer, Val LaBanca, the engineer. It's a team of people here, and we don't do it alone. It's not just one person. We try to be prepared for every discussion. I like to go into every hour feeling like I am as prepared as possible because it facilitates a great discussion with our guests, with our audience, and we can't do that without support, without the staff we have and without you. So 454-6300, your dollars are doubled right now. 454-6300. You can go online at WXXI.org/give right now to double your dollars. Scott, we'll check back with you a little bit later in the hour here.
Absolutely.
All right, that's we got a ways to go, but we'd like to end this today, and we need you to do that. Let's not do this all week. Let's do it one day only. We're talking to Anne-Marie Lubenow, who's the director of the Rudy Bruner Awards for Urban Excellence. It's sponsored by the Bruner Foundation. She will be in Rochester a week from tonight to kick off the 2016 Reshaping Rochester series by the Community Design Center. And here from the Community Design Center, our executive director, Mo Duggan, board member, Howard Decker. We're talking about what equity by design means. And we've been going down the list here of the various projects that have received these Rudy Bruner Awards. But Mo, Howard, if you look around Rochester, do you feel that our community is engaging these issues enough? I mean, I know we're not on the list for a project this year. It doesn't mean that we're not engaging in equity by design. Are we doing a better job now than we used to be? I'm sort of thinking big picture, thinking about justice, thinking about environmental justice and social justice on these design issues.
I think you can always do more. And when we talked about this series, this was something that we said we really need. We have an opportunity now. The community is really focused on this area. And what can we bring to the table? Why is it so important to talk about neighborhoods and what needs to be in a healthy neighborhood to make the people there thrive?
And I think, too, that one of the things that's true about the Design Center is that we engage in a process naturally and have for over 10 years now that does weigh on this conversation about equity. Because part of the conversation about equity in urban design has to do with the process. And for us, the process must begin by giving voice to the neighbors who live in a community or a zone or an area. And their voice comes first. We don't go to a community or a neighborhood with solutions. We go there to discover what solutions they know will impact their lives in the best possible way. And so equity by design not only has to do with transportation and projects and green space, but it has as well to do with an equitable, fair process mm-hmm. that gives everybody, poor or otherwise, access to the creation of choices that make a better life for each person in our city.
I want to get some of the feedback from our audience, and I know we've been throwing a lot of phone numbers at you because it's a pledge day, but you can also call the program if you want to weigh in or with a comment or a question about design and what equity by design may mean here in Rochester and in the Rochester Finger Lakes region. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you're right here in Rochester, Brian writes to us and just says, can you ask your panel, Evan, about gentrification and thank you for another important discussion. He didn't go any further than that. And this word comes up a lot when we right. talk about design, et cetera. So let me start with Anne-Marie Lubenow. Gentrification, how do you define it and is it a pejorative in design?
Sure. That issue actually came up in all of our site visits to the five projects this year. And one of the ways we often refer to gentrification or another way of talking about it is about displacement. You know, a question, I think, when we discuss design and design in respect to equity is for whom? You know, when a project is built, when development happens, who will it benefit? And I think ideally we want to create and foster development that benefits everybody in the city. Everybody in the community. And to the point that Howard made earlier, I think that process is really an important part of it, that engaging people in the process of envisioning and planning for the future of their community makes a big difference.
Howard?
I think one of the things that's true about gentrification is that it has to do with displacement typically, as Anne-Marie has said, displacement typically resulting from increase in property values. And as those of us who live here in Rochester know so well, our property values don't increase much, no matter what we're doing. So gentrification is a more distant challenge for us. What's really important first is to take neighborhoods that are underserved and underdesigned and bring equitable quality design to them. And then we can struggle with the questions about increasing property values and displacement. There are a lot of other reasons why people get displaced rather than rising property values, but gentrification is not a really urgent problem for us yet. And I think it may be out ahead of us in the future, but not so much of an issue just at the moment.
When you hear it, the word, is it a pejorative?
Always, and understandably, because in many places throughout the United States and around the world, as cities have redeveloped themselves, poor people have been forced out to the edges and beyond, and it can have a very pejorative effect on an urban environment. We don't have that problem here at the moment, but it could be something that we have to face at some moment in the future.
And Karen writes to us, is what's happening in Flint an example of a lack of design justice? It's an interesting question,
I
guess.
It is. Very good. If you talk about what Howard has mentioned earlier about, you know, access and choice, did those people have the access and choice? No. If people around them that had been making the policies and making the decisions had been thinking about social justice and had been thinking about just sustainability, would that have happened? Perhaps not. So I think there is something to be said about that.
What do you think, Howard?
Well, I think, you know, you have a city like Flint that failed to pay attention to the quality of its infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons it failed to pay attention to the quality of its infrastructure, specifically its water system, is because poor people lived there and nobody gave a damn. And I think one of the things that this series is going to try and touch upon is the fact that we have to create an urban environment where everybody cares about everybody, whether we're rich or poor, whatever our background may be. We have to pay attention to one another, pay attention to one another's needs, help to take care of one another. In Flint, you had a water system that was delivering poison to the neighbors, and they were not paying attention. And shame on them for not paying attention. So, yeah, it has a lot to do with equity, I think, and fairness.
Very, very thought-provoking.
Yeah, Anne-Marie, what do you think?
I think it also reminds us of the importance of thinking about infrastructure as part of the design of our built environment. Mm-hmm. It's often easy to forget about systems that are underground where we don't see them, or perhaps something that is sort of part of a network that we take for granted. And I think recognizing that we need to be thinking not just a few years, but decades, if not 100 years, into the future of our cities, and recognize that these systems that support our cities are just as important as, you know, putting up a new building that we see every day on the street.
You know, the Flint story is so sad on so many levels, and that's, you know, an example of just, I think, egregiously, as Howard said, just not caring about a segment of the community that doesn't have the same means. And I think environmental justice is not always as blunt and obvious, but there are a lot of issues wrapped up in what we would call environmental justice. And you're going to hear more next Tuesday from Dr. Julian Ogeman on that subject. He's spoken at a number of conferences. In fact, this morning I was watching a number of his presentations on video that you can find. And so he will be weighing in on environmental justice as a part of equity by design next Tuesday. Does Flint come up? I don't know, but I think, you know, those are interesting questions tied up in that. So Karen, thank you for the question there. Anne-Marie Lubinow is on the line with us, and the awards that we're talking about, the Bruner Awards, include not only Miller's Court in Baltimore that we've talked about, Falls Park on the Reedy River in Greenville, but I was looking at Quixote Village in Olympia, Washington, and this is very interesting, if I can ask about this one, Anne-Marie, because you've got a village of 30 small homes for previously homeless adults, 2.7 acres, a community center with a kitchen and showers and a large vegetable garden. It began when a protest camp of homeless individuals sprang up in protest of a city ordinance that forbade lying down or sitting on sidewalks. And for 6 years, the protest camp moved from church lot to church lot until a nonprofit started to support them. It led to the creation of Quixote Village in 2013. I mean, it's not a perfect parallel to what we saw with Sanctuary Village in Rochester, but there are echoes, and every community has to decide how you help a homeless population. Tell me why Quixote Village landed on the list for you as a silver medalist in the Bruner Awards.
Right. Well, every year we put together a six-member selection committee that determines the medalists, and, you know, like so many of our other 2015 winners, the topic, the issue of homelessness, is something that touches many cities in our country. And we've had a number of projects and winners over the years of the Rudy Bruner Award that have addressed this issue all in different ways. And I think what really made Quixote Village special for the selection committee as they discussed the applicants was the fact that it's partly a kind of a homegrown response on the part of the community. It's the community's response to helping a segment of the population that was being pushed to the margins of the community, that was being, you know, if you talk about justice issues, they were, you know, simply not allowed to occupy downtown. They were pushed out of the storefronts where they were that they were occupying, and in response created a homeless encampment. And that, in turn, was hosted over many years, 7 years in total, by different churches in the communities that volunteered to provide space for the community and provide volunteers. This was a temporary solution, and over the long term, it was recognized that there needed to be a permanent solution. And rather than, and actually the product, Quixote Village itself, the community of 30 tiny houses, is a product of a community-driven process. So it was a local architect who volunteered his time to work with people who were living in the tent encampment to really understand their needs and to craft a solution that, that helped them.
Yeah, Anne-Marie, before the hour began, I was just speaking to our intern, Kate, who's very much interested in urban design. I think equity by design is, she gravitated right to the subject. And we were talking about the fact that when you are working with the homeless population, you have to do it in a way that is, I think, thoughtful and effective, because we know that just creating housing isn't always good enough. There has to be support system. The goal is not just to put someone in a house overnight, but to give them a chance to have a start that is lasting and long term. And Kate was saying, you know, when she checked it out, there's a waiting list for Quixote Village, that there is interest and that there obviously is a kind of a sticking that's going on, that there is some success there that isn't just a day or a week, that there is some long-term success. And my guess is that speaks to the thoughtfulness of the design, which isn't just the aesthetic, but also how it's operated.
Right. And I would say in this case, too, there are many different ways to approach housing for the homeless. And in this case, they had a number of people who had been living in tents in the woods. So that sense of independence was very important to them, and thus the solution of 30 individual cottages, tiny houses, rather than one big building where each person had a room or a small apartment. So I think that speaks to a characteristic that is a common thread through many of our award winners, is how do these projects respond to the unique circumstances of place, the people living there and the communities that surround them.
That's an echo of what Howard Decker from the Community Design Center of Rochester said earlier this hour, and says just about every time we see him, which is that thoughtful design is not just what would look good here, but going to that community and talking to people who live there or working with people who will be impacted to understand better before you put a shovel in the ground.
And I think one of the things that we learn over and over, we've just, Mo and I have been doing it again this week. Mm-hmm. We're in a neighborhood where we're currently doing some projects. The neighbors, the residents, they know what's best. They have a passion for their place. They have a commitment to the place. They want to lead a better life. They know how to lead a better life. And all we have to do is listen and empower. And so, and that's a very significant part of the process that the Design Center engages, as I said earlier, is just to listen, because one of the things that the neighbors told us, and this is a relatively poor neighborhood here in the city, mm-hmm. is that they didn't understand why they couldn't have projects that weren't ugly, which reflects on the thing you were saying earlier about one of Anne-Marie's projects. They don't want ugly things. And a lot of times, of course, they're saying that because in poorer neighborhoods, the neighbors often get things that are in fact ugly because they have nothing to say about it. But I think it was really an opportunity for them to say, wait a minute, we want to play a significant role in determining what happens in our place. And in fact, they care enormously and they know incredibly and clearly exactly what needs to be done.
Equity by Design is the discussion. Thanks to the Community Design Center of Rochester. Mo Duggan, the executive director, is here. Howard Decker is a board member and an architect. He's here. On the line with us is Anne-Marie Lubenow, the director of the Rudy Bruner Award for Urban Excellence. And Anne-Marie is going to be here in a week as part of the discussion, what is equity by design? That's a week from tonight at Gleason Works Auditorium on University Avenue from 7 to 9. Tickets are still available if you go to cdcrochester.org as they kick off their 2016 Reshaping Rochester series of discussions. We've got some phone calls to get to, but let's get a short break in and come back and continue the discussion of what equity really means in design right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, murder in Geneseo after a breakup. We're talking about emotional health, mental health, relationship health, and related issues in our first hour. Then second hour, a preview of First Friday. A lot going on in Rochester on First Fridays, and the art community joins us to discuss that and more. We will talk with you on Wednesday. All right, before we get to your phone calls here on Connections, I want to bring back Scott Feibusch one more time, my colleague, just to pop in here and remind our listeners that today, and hopefully today only, is our pledge drive. We've got a target number in mind. If we get there, we're done. The minute we get there, we're done. If somebody calls in right now and fills the rest of it, we're done. 454-6300. Pledges right now, 454-6300, are doubled. And I hope we get there. We're slowly making our way, Scott.
$84,000 is the most recent number.
It's good.
Which is good. We're more than halfway there. That's the good news. There's a lot to do yet before we get to 6 o'clock or maybe even earlier this afternoon.
Or tomorrow morning.
Or tomorrow afternoon. I don't want to go there, though. I don't want to go there because with the help of this challenge, there's no better offer that you're going to get later in the day or tomorrow morning that you're not going to get right now when you call 454-6300 in Rochester, 800-295-9994. The WXXI.org website, WEOS.org, the WXXI mobile app. All of those ways of pledging will be doubled, thanks to our friend in Canandaigua, who's been a member for more than 25 years, since before we had local midday talk here on this radio station. And this kind of conversation, some of the things that you talk about are not sexy topics. Nobody is going to get rich talking about infrastructure. Nobody is going to get rich talking about urban development. Nobody's going to get rich talking about county government, but they matter. They are important things to talk about, and you make that possible with that call right now to 454-6300.
You know, it was a listener, Karen, who wrote in and had a question about design, equity by design, and connected it to Flint and what's going on there. And, you know, everyone on the panel said, what a great question. And, you know, as great of a host as I am, and I am, you know, among the best you've ever heard. That's not even close to true. I understand. I'm kidding. I'm being self-deprecating here. What makes the show so good, and this is where I'm being very, very honest, is the quality of the listeners, the thoughtful questions that come in. I can only prepare so much. But the fact that we open up the phones, we communicate in various ways, our listeners will often come in with a question, and I will say after the hour, why did I not think of that? But thank goodness they did. And it works because they contribute, they support it, and we can keep doing it. It's 454-6300. It's toll-free, and it's right now, and it's your chance to double your pledge, 454-6300.
And by the way, we've made that comparison several times over the course of the show today to what other public stations have in other cities. Some of the stations that have talk shows don't even take live phone calls. Some of them are pre-recorded. Some of them just don't have that kind of interaction that we are fortunate enough to have here with the kind of audience that we have here. But we come to you with this quid pro quo, and we say, okay, we bring this to you commercial-free, 2 hours a day, every weekday, all year long, and a couple of times a year we come to you and say, okay, now you got to pay the bill for it because nobody else does. The money doesn't come from government. The money doesn't come entirely from underwriters or any other sources. It really depends on listener contributions. And if you make that call now, if you don't wait until the end of the day today or tomorrow morning, if we're still here tomorrow morning, if you do it now, management here looks at that and they say, oh, you know what? Look, there's a lot of support for Connections. Let's keep putting resources there. This is important to our listeners. So this is how you show it with that phone call to 454-6300, 800-295-9994, or WXXI.org, and you get those dollars doubled until 2 o'clock.
Thank you, Scott. Scott thinks we're not going to be back here tomorrow morning. I want you to prove him right. At 454-6300. That's my colleague Scott Feibusch. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Reshaping Rochester series. The Community Design Center of Rochester has a series. And Mo Duggan, how many different events do you have as part of the series this year?
Altogether, there's five, including one lunch with the mayor of Greenville.
All right, very good. So five events coming up here, and you've got What is Equity by Design? That event is 1 week from tonight at Gleason Works Auditorium. And one of the guests, one of the two featured speakers, is Anne-Marie Lubenow, the director of the Rudy Brunner Awards for Urban Excellence, among other things. She's got her own colorful resume and a lot of experience in the field. She'll be here. Howard Decker is a board member of the Community Design Center of Rochester and an architect. He's in studio with us. And Mo Duggan, the executive director of the Community Design Center, is in studio with us. And we're talking about equity by design. What is it in terms of design that sometimes prevents us from looking at environmental justice, social justice, community inclusion, and how can we improve design to make sure those things are not forgotten? That's part of the discussion, and let's get to some of your phone calls now for our panel. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yes, you know, when I was a small kid, which is a long time ago now, we lived in a low-income housing project, which is very modest, very fair quality, but clean. Today, I've noticed a lot of the low-income housing projects are costing anywhere from $150,000 to $300,000 a unit. And I guess my question to the panel is, that seems to be pretty excessive. And I guess that's my question. What are your thoughts there? Can maybe reusing some of the housing stock in some of the cities where they're demolishing a lot of housing stock, like in the city of Rochester, they have a program to demolish properties and buildings and not to reuse them. Do you think that could be a better alternative?
John, thanks for the question. Let's start local, and then we'll go broader. Howard Decker?
Well, that's a real softball question, and thank you, John, for raising that issue. Basically, Rochester has a program called Project Green, which is really our teardown program. And the targeted number of housing units to be torn down is somewhere near 3,000. And the city budgets between $25,000 and $30,000 a unit to tear them down. If we took those units and we took that budget and we applied it in a different way and we acknowledged sweat equity and we made properties available as we are now doing through the Development Corporation at a very low cost, then yes, many of the housing needs could be met by housing that's here already that we don't have to knock down. We can save it, reuse it, and it'll serve a perfectly great life well into the future. Cities can no longer afford to throw anything away. That's one of the things that's true about questions related to environmental justice. And we can't afford to throw our buildings away. So it's time for us to really learn that we can recycle and reuse instead of tossing it out. The other thing that's true about what John says is that right now in Rochester, the need for housing units is somewhere around 14,000 or 15,000 units, plus or minus, give or take a couple thousand. So we have, 3,000 units that we want to knock down, and we've got five times that number of units that are needed and being called for. It seems quite straightforward that we just take what we have to the maximum extent that we can, acknowledging that some of these units are, in fact, so far gone that they're not salvageable. We acknowledge that. But let's take everything that we can and reuse it. And, yeah, we're going to save a bundle of money if we do it properly.
Mo, you want to weigh in on that?
You know, I would just say, too, I don't want to make the problem bigger than it is already is, John, but I think you're right. And the other thing that I see are people that want to age in place in the houses that they do live in some of these neighborhoods. And they're having trouble doing it. They're having trouble getting money to repair a roof. They're having trouble getting money for the HVAC in their house. So that we don't make the problem worse, I'd like to see more money going into stabilization of the housing stock that we have that's sort of on the margin so that we're not ending up with another 1,000 units. But your point's well taken, and you're right. If we can find a way to cut through that barrier and match folks up with the housing stock we already have, and to Howard's point, figure out maybe some ways to teach some job skills around carpentry and things like that. It would be a win for everyone involved.
Anne Marie, how do you see this issue more nationally then?
I think it's a point that applies to so many places. And I think another dimension of the issue is the recognizing that when we have existing buildings and existing communities, there are often rich social networks, or there's a rich social fabric that is equally important to creating a sustainable community and supporting people in their lives. And we actually have a winner from 2013 Congo Street Initiative in Dallas, which actually took this issue on head-on. In this case, they worked with existing homeowners on a one-block-long street in Dallas to help them renovate their existing homes to make them more energy efficient, to address some deterioration that had happened from lack of maintenance. So in the process, they engaged existing homeowners, they engaged volunteers from the community, and they kept the homeowners in place. And in this case, they actually built a new home called the Holding House, so a homeowner could move into that house while their own house was being renovated. So there really are other options out there. We just have not focused on them as a way of thinking about creating affordable housing.
John, thanks for the phone call. Anne Marie is the director of the Rudy Brunner Awards for Urban Excellence. And looking at the list, there's one more project I wanted to mention, because just from the photograph, it looks like the Rochester Public Market. It's the Grand Rapids Downtown Market in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And this speaks to, we've been talking about access. We've been talking about what equity by design is. And so often it's access. And sometimes that means food access. Sometimes that means markets, and I just would love for Anne Marie to explain a little bit about this particular project and what we might learn from it.
Sure. The Grand Rapids Downtown Market is a wonderful project, a wonderful example of addressing broader kind of community goals. So part of the project, so it is a brand new building that provides a public market space that helps to connect regional farmers with consumers in the area. That's on the ground floor, so it's sort of a traditional marketplace. And then what really stands out about this project is its ambitious social agenda. So the second floor of the building includes a educational classroom space to teach people in the community about food. There are cooking classes. They have a space to support local entrepreneurship, so there's an incubator kitchen, which is helping individuals within the community nurture their own businesses around food, and to also help connect people living in the surrounding community. The area immediately surrounding the market is a low-income community, and what the people who have been running the market have found that for many folks in the community, they are not familiar with using fresh food, fresh produce. So part of what they're doing is providing sponsored classes to enable low-income residents to take cooking classes and then actually purchase food from the market to take those skills home to their families.
And that is the Grand Rapids Downtown Market. Any echoes and parallels here, Mo and Howard, to that one?
Yeah, you know, there just a lot of times we talk about things that, you know, other folks are doing, and we do have a parallel here, and it's something that we've helped in a small way at the Design Center, the Greenhouse Collaborative that's being done on Webster next to the Freedom Market is planning to do a lot of things just like that, with both an indoor greenhouse, raised vegetable patches, some community education around how to eat and grow healthful foods, and cooking classes and things like that. And that's a really neat collaborative that involves a professor at U of R, Joyce Dunkel, 14621 Freedom Market, and they're all coming together and they're building from strengths. And what we did was we were able to provide funding for a pre-development study, some phasing work, and a cost estimate. So now they're going to be able to take that and go hopefully get the money to actually get it built. So it's a pretty cool thing. And just reflecting on what Anne-Marie said, those are the kinds of things that can really change, in this case, the Beechwood neighborhood completely.
All right, Anne-Marie, before we let you go then, you'll be here in a week, and what's part of the presentation? We've been talking about the awards and what we can learn and looking around the country, but what will you be talking about here?
Sure. I'll also be talking about the conversation that's happening nationally around design and equity. This is something that's of interest to folks across the country, as well as some examples of Rudy Brunner Award winners that touch upon the subject, as we've discussed today, as well as some common themes that we're seeing among all of our Rudy Brunner Award winners over the years and that address economic and social issues in our communities.
Howard, what are you hoping comes out of the discussion a week from tonight?
I hope that everybody comes to the series and comes away thinking how they can make the city better, learning lessons about how to make the city better, how to help their neighbors, how to see the place come together and in a sense of fairness and evenness for everybody in every part of the region.
Do you get the sense, Howard, in the work that you've done and in the career that you've had in looking at how design happens, are we doing a better job of not just looking at one site, one project? What would a building look like here? What would a development look like here on its own, as opposed to how does it stitch into the community? How does it fit on a street? How does it help a neighborhood or not? What are the other impacts, et cetera? Are we doing a better job of that?
I think slowly but surely we are, in fact, doing a better job at it. And one of the things that the Design Center stands for is trying to help us to understand how to make that happen as positively and as quickly as possible. And really, it's just about listening.
One of these days, can I have you come in and just tell me all the places we've done a terrible job of that?
I'd love to. I'd love to.
I know. And, you know, when I joke, but, you know, we have to learn from mistakes. And that's one thing that I've seen Howard at conferences and speeches say, you know, you got to learn from the mistakes that you've
made.
We've
got some legacy mistakes that are Lulus that we could talk about.
Yeah, so thanks for being here, Howard. Nice to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure.
With the Community Design Center of Rochester. Mo, good luck. 1 week from tonight and more information at cdcrochester.org. You can see the whole series that's coming up there for Reshaping Rochester. Who's coming? What are the subjects? How to get tickets and more? So if they don't see you a week from tonight out at Gleason Works,
right,
there's a lot more coming up here.
There is.
Thanks for being here. Thanks. And our thanks to Anne-Marie Lubinow. Again, thank you for taking the time to tell us about what the Rudy Brunner Awards are for Urban Excellence. Anne-Marie shared some very interesting stories from around the country, and I know we look forward to seeing you here in a week. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I look forward to being there next week.
Great discussion. A lot of feedback online. And just a reminder, you've got 2.5 minutes. If you appreciate what we do here every day on Connections, my guess is if you can hear my voice right now, you do. 454-6300 is our pledge line, and we're hoping to be one day only, one and done. And we're going to match your pledge for the next 2.5 minutes. So it's a great time to call 454-6300 and join the people who voted with their wallets and say, this matters, and we're going to keep it. Thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of this broadcast. Kate Cowie-Haskell, great work today on a subject that I know she's very passionate about. So it's been great working with her. Megan Mack, the producer of the program. And I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk to you Wednesday on member-supported Public Radio.